Hello there. Today is Wednesday, January 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, could Russian hackers be actively looking for a 2016 repeat?
It's possible that what the Russians are doing is trying to gather more information that they can use to influence the U.S. elections, like they did with Hillary Clinton's emails back in the 2016 election.
The trial of President Donald Trump, expected to begin today. No word on whether it will include witnesses. Also ahead, Billie Eilish again making news. It's all on today's International Edition. The Democratic Party's leading presidential candidates spar over Iraq, the war, foreign policy in their final debate showdown before primary voting begins. Just six candidates are gathering in Des Moines, Iowa, each eager to seize a dose of final days of momentum on national television before the February 3rd caucuses. That debate still happening, but joining us live now in studio for an update is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, Jim, given the recent events with Iran, national security obviously has been a big issue.
Right, that's right. And that's what they really focused on early on. There was quite an effort by several of the Democratic contenders to criticize President Trump's actions on Iran. Joe Biden, for example, saying we've lost our standing in the region, that many of the allies now see the U.S. and Iran on the same level, sort of an equivalence that he said is a problem for the United States. And, of course, it opened up, though, Biden's judgment on the Iraq war, Bernie Sanders reminding everyone he voted against it, Sanders, while Biden voted for it. And then Sanders expressing concern, as did Pete Buttigieg, that perhaps what's going on now with Iran could lead to a wider conflict. So there was that focus, national security. There were also clashes over health care. We've seen that before. How costly a health care reform package do you want? And also over some trade deals coming up with China and with the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So the Democrats had their scrapes and their irritations, but in some ways it was not quite as boisterous or aggressive as many people thought going in.
Right, and they thought that there could be some fireworks between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders over a supposed comment that he made about a woman not being able to win the election that he had apparently said in private. He denies it. Apparently that she didn't.
Well, that did come up, and I think it was a big moment for Elizabeth Warren, who basically, she said on one hand, I don't want to pick a fight with Bernie about this. But then she went in to say, look at the people on the stage here. The men have lost 10 elections. Mm-hmm. The only two women on the stage, referring to herself and Amy Klobuchar, are the ones who haven't lost an election. So she was asking that in the context of can a woman beat Donald Trump? And of course, many of the others, of course, chimed in. Of course, they believe now that a woman can beat Donald Trump.
Yes, and there was definitely a little bit of women unite in that moment she called out her.
And we'll see how that plays out, because this is important. Sanders has been gaining momentum in the polls in Iowa. So with this, what happens, we don't know. But there's a cluster of four candidates at the top. And it's really sort of a jump ball right now, what goes on in Iowa, and that really is an important first step in the whole nomination process.
And just to wrap it up, anybody you think that hurt themselves or helped themselves moving forward, or is it kind of like just even?
No, I think it may continue on where things stand, but that may not be great news for someone like Amy Klobuchar or Pete Buttigieg, both of whom need to move up in the polls. But we'll see. 3 weeks now until the voters start to weigh in.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday the Senate will formally begin the impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump early next week. The beginning of the second phase of impeachment will follow the transmission of articles of impeachment from the Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives to the Republican-majority Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House will send official impeachment charges to the Senate today. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The House is set to vote on sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate, which would then launch just the third ever impeachment trial of a president. GOP Chief Mitch McConnell says he's aiming for Tuesday after running into Republican opposition for a plan to simply dismiss the charges.
Our members feel that we have an obligation to listen to the arguments.
He's also under growing pressure to call fresh witnesses.
If you want the truth, You have to have witnesses. You have to have documents.
Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says more Republicans are coming around to that idea, though McConnell says it's too early to decide on allowing new testimony. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at VOAnews.com. A new Space Force chief has officially been sworn in. The Jamal Khashoggi's fiance calls his murder at the Saudi embassy in Turkey the trial a joke. Turkish leader threatening action in Libya and Syria. And the EU investment plan is aiming for carbon neutrality by 2050. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Trump administration is hailing the phase one trade war truce between the U.S. and China as a huge step forward in establishing a long-term trade relationship between the two of the world's biggest economies. China is also one of the largest buyers of some U.S. crops. As VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, while U.S. farmers welcome the phase one deal, they also have concerns about how it will be implemented.
Just before farmer Evan Hultin started planting crops in his fields outside Princeton, Illinois last March, he made a risky decision not to grow soybeans. He was losing money on the crop, subject to tariffs amid the escalating trade war with China.
No beans this year for us. After about 3 months of the trade war, it was pretty clear that the president had long-term goals in mind, and at the time, my dad and I talked, and we were way more comfortable with our ability to produce high-yield corn.
Today, a month after harvesting his corn, and almost a year after making the decision to skip soybeans, Hultin has no regrets.
For harvestability, this wet fall and late fall, corn was a lot easier to handle than trying to get beans out. So in the end, I'm going to stick with it, whether it was maybe the right thing or not. But
even though he still has a few months before his tractors are back in the fields, this year will be different.
We're going to move back to some beans. Now that the market's hanging in the mid-$9 range rather than the upper 7s and lower 8s a year ago, I'm much more confident in our ability to be profitable at those prices.
Those soybean prices are affected by reports the Phase 1 trade agreement between the U.S. and China will curb tariffs and increase U.S. agricultural exports from current levels, according to President Trump, up to as much as $40 billion annually. The potential jump is welcome news for trade war-weary farmers like Hultin.
I'd say overjoyed to hear some positive news on that front, but yeah, I think cautious optimism is definitely the best way to describe my feelings.
Illinois Farm Bureau senior economist Mike Dougherty says Hultin's caution is well-placed.
There's doubt out there whether they can reach $40 billion. That would be a big increase because to get to $40 billion, you'd have to buy a lot of U.S. soybeans. You'd have to buy such a quantity of soybeans, it looks like China would almost have to back off their soybean purchases from Brazil. And that doesn't seem real likely they'd want to do that.
But Dougherty says China also needs U.S. crops to support its growing population and expanding middle class.
That's what was driving demand before. It wasn't a trade agreement with China. It was simply their market supply and demand is what was the primary driver of selling U.S. and Illinois soybeans to China. And we'd like to get back to that market-driven demand.
Evan Hultin would also like to get back in business with China and, under phase one, sell more of the corn and soybeans he grows on his farm this year. But he's not quite ready to bet the farm on it.
We still know there's a delicate balance here, and China's still China. So, yeah, I think it's going to take some hard evidence before we really shake some of the stress that we felt from this issue.
An issue Hultin hopes the United States and China can avoid once they finalize a permanent long-term trade agreement. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Princeton, Illinois.
A Democratic senator said Tuesday he has at least 51 votes to support a bipartisan resolution asserting that President Donald Trump must seek approval from Congress before engaging in further military action against Iran. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia says the Senate could vote as soon as next week on the measure, which is co-sponsored by two Republican senators and has support from at least two more Republicans. Kaine has long pushed for congressional action, reasserting congressional power to declare war, but he said Tuesday that there is renewed support for the effort after the Trump administration killed Iran's top general earlier this month. Joining us to talk about what this means for presidential war power decisions is Joel Paul, professor at the University of California, Hastings Law School. Can you just explain all of this to us?
Well, the Constitution is not clear about a lot of things, but one thing the Constitution is very clear about is that all of the power to declare war is vested exclusively in Congress. Only Congress can authorize a war, only Congress can raise the military, can fund the military, and can regulate the military. The president has authority as commander-in-chief once Congress has authorized the use of force. Now, there's two exceptions to that. One is if the United States has been invaded. So if there's a foreign power that invades the United States, the president has the authority to respond to an invasion immediately without first going to Congress to give Congress time to act. The other possibility is if you have an insurrection. So when, for example, the South seceded from the North during the Civil War, Lincoln acted prior to any authorization from Congress, and the Supreme Court held that that was permissible given the circumstances. But the president does not have authority in this situation to act on his own. And so the introduction of any military force into a situation where there is hostilities likely would require some kind of authorization from Congress, which, of course, the president did not have.
The president often refers to Article 2, saying that Article 2 in the Constitution gives him the right to do whatever he wants.
He needs to read Article 2. Article 2 says that the president is commander-in-chief. It says the president has authority to receive foreign ambassadors. The president has authority with the advice and consent of the Senate to negotiate treaties and to appoint members of the Supreme Court and other foreign ministers, ambassadors. But the president certainly does not have the authority to use force unilaterally without some authorization from Congress, except in the circumstances that I mentioned.
The president's reasoning behind the killing of General Soleimani has continued to evolve and change. Initially, it was that there was some sort of imminent threat to the United States or United States targets overseas. Would that be enough for a president to justify something like this?
This killing fits the dictionary definition of an assassination. Whether the president wants to call it an assassination or not, when you target an individual who is a government official, that's an assassination. So that, I don't think, is relevant to the question of whether or not he can do this constitutionally. The constitutional question here is whether there was an imminent threat to U.S. forces. If, for example, the Iranians were planning an imminent attack on U.S. forces in Iraq, then arguably it might justify the president using force. But the problem is that the president doesn't seem to have any evidence of that, and he keeps changing his rationale. So unless the president had some evidence that would support that assumption, his use of force was unconstitutional.
There has been a lot of concern from world leaders in Europe and others about the actions that the U.S. took without even, you know, letting them know when they have troops, obviously, in that part of the world as well. Was there any sort of international crime committed here by the U.S. or war crime or anything to that extent?
I think that's a really important question here. The laws of war do not permit the assassination of a foreign leader or of a foreign government official. The laws of war only permit targeting a military target, and an individual is not a military target. So that's one problem. The other problem here is that under the United Nations Charter, it is not permissible to use force in international relations except in self-defense, unless the president can show that there's clear evidence that the United States was acting in self-defense, our actions would be illegal under international law, and that's made even worse by the fact that the actions took place not on Iranian territory, but on Iraqi territory. So in addition to violating the laws of war, we are also guilty of having violated the sovereignty of Iraq.
All right, that's Joel Paul, professor at the University of California, Hastings Law School. Meanwhile, France, Britain, and Germany have triggered a mechanism that puts the Iran nuclear deal into dispute, which, if no resolution is reached, could lead to a return to the UN sanctions it lifted. Lucy Fielder reports.
The deal requires Iran to curb its nuclear program, which it has always insisted is peaceful. But U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the United States out in 2018, saying it was too weak. Washington has ramped up sanctions that are severely damaging Iran's economy. Since then, Iran has reduced its compliance, saying the Trump administration's actions give it the right. The question is now whether the European powers' step is a nail in the deal's coffin. The EU, which acts as guarantor and must now inform fellow signatories Russia, China and Iran itself, said it wanted a return to compliance, not to sanctions.
It's Lucy Fielder reporting. A U.S. cybersecurity company says Russian military agents successfully hacked the Ukrainian gas company at the center of President Donald Trump's impeachment case. It's not clear if anything was stolen from the company or if any information was gleaned and what the ultimate goal was. Joining us to talk more about this, though, is Jamil Jaffer, Vice President of Strategy, Partnerships and Corporate Development with IronNet National Security. He's also the founder and executive director of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. It sounds like the timing and the scale suggest Russia could be looking for potentially more embarrassing material for Joe Biden like they did with Hillary Clinton. Is that what you see?
You know, the report that we heard coming out of Area 1 Security, which is a company run by Oren Falkowicz, who used to also work at the National Security Agency, what Area 1 found was evidence that a known Russian hacking group, a group called Fancy Bear, was engaged in an effort early November to get into a series of Ukrainian companies. They found this hack in January, soon after New Year's, but found evidence that it had gone back to November. And what they found about all these Ukrainian companies was that they were all subsidiaries of Burisma. And in fact, interestingly, one of the organizations that they were focused on, it was an organization whose leadership had a connection, it was a television production company that was actually founded by Mr. Zelensky, and so that the current president of Ukraine. And so it looks like they were looking for information about a guy that was at that company who Mr. Zelensky ultimately appointed ahead of the Ukrainian security service. So clearly they were looking for information about Zelensky, about his senior leaders. That's not surprising because the Russians, you know, obviously have a relationship or at times strained and at times a working relationship with Ukraine. They obviously took over a part of Ukraine during the Obama administration, Crimea. So there's a tense level of relationship between the two countries. And so it's not surprising they would go looking for that information. It's not surprising they would go after a major Ukrainian gas company and its subsidiaries. What some of the reports have suggested, I think not necessarily based on stuff reported by Area 1, but just because of the atmospherics and the timing, that they may be looking for further information about Joe Biden or about his son Hunter Biden, who served on the board of Burisma and is at the heart of this phone call that's in the heart of the impeachment debate between President Trump and President Zelensky.
Right. So given the timing, stealing email credentials, is it safe to assume that this is somewhat of a repeat of Russia's interference in the last election? And who knows if whatever information they found, that when they could decide to release it? I mean, they could wait, they could hold it. I mean, how does that work?
Well, look, certainly it's possible that what the Russians are doing is trying to gather more information that they can use to influence the U.S. elections, like they did with Hillary Clinton's emails back in the 2016 election. That being said, this is not a case where they're going after the emails of an American politician, to wit, the candidate that was running for office. At most, what they might be looking for here is information about a candidate's child, nonetheless relevant to the election because of what we've seen happening with the impeachment debate. But there's also a very clear explanation for this hacking effort or this email penetration effort that has absolutely nothing to do with Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, and that's just the Russians trying to gather information on Zelensky and his inner circle and the people around him and a particularly interesting Ukrainian gas company.
Seems awful coincidental, doesn't it, that it would be the same company that is at the heart of this whole impeachment thing. Joe Biden's son worked there, was on the board.
Well, we don't know what other companies in Ukraine or elsewhere Fancy Bear is going after. We know that Fancy Bear is involved in all sorts of hacking attempts on behalf of the Russian GRU, which is their military intelligence unit. So we know that Fancy Bear has gone after lots of companies and lots of other targets. Yes, they were actively involved in the 2016 election. They're now actively involved in this case. But it could very well be coincidental in the sense that it's not necessarily obvious that that's what's at stake here. That is certainly the surmise, that's what people have surmised based on prior activity and based on the timing relative to the election. But again, with them looking for stuff about Zelensky and his close associates, there is another not irrational and frankly very sensible explanation. So it's just more to be seen about what Area 1 found, what other cybersecurity firms find on this hack, but certainly a interesting piece of information now that's out there in the discussion, right as we're teeing up here in the U.S., by the way, for an impeachment trial on a very much related issue.
Russia has already been successful in interfering in elections, and from what we're seeing, they haven't been stopped, and there are growing concerns that they've grown even more stealthier since 2016. Would you say that's probably the case? And if so, why is nothing being done?
Absolutely. The Russians have gotten better. It's been 4 years since the 2016 election. Just as a matter of sort of normal technological development, their capabilities would have advanced. But they're also very focused on the 2020 elections and trying to influence them and trying to undermine Americans' confidence in our election system, in our elected leaders, and our rule of law institutions, the FBI, the Justice Department, the intelligence agencies, and the like. You might ask yourself, well, why would Russia be so interested in doing that in 2020? And the answer is very simple. They were wildly successful beyond their wildest dreams in 2016. And how do you know that? It's because every single discussion in this country about politics goes back to the Russian election act in 2016, the impeachment debate we're having today, the partisan fighting between 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and Capitol Hill. It all traces back to that same thing. And the reason the work of the American people is not getting done today in Congress or in the executive branch is largely because the Russians successfully created massive discord in our country.
That's Jamil Jaffer. He's Vice President of Strategy Partnerships and Corporate Development with IronNet National Security and the founder of and executive director of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. So 37,000 African asylum seekers in Israel live in limbo. They are allowed to work and their children go to Israeli schools, but they have no official status and live on the fringes of Israeli society. But now a new social enterprise project is aiming to help them share their stories and culinary culture with native Israelis. Linda Gradstein reports from Tel Aviv.
Chef Asmait Merhatzion is a 30-year-old asylum seeker from Eritrea. She tells her story as she and the 12 Israeli participants together cook a series of vegetarian Eritrean dishes.
When I was in college, I was arranging women or girls there to pray or something, and they catched us on this time, and they asked who organized. I organized it. That's why they are thinking we are our meeting is political, but it's not political, it's religious.
She served two short stints in prison and then escaped to Sudan. From there, she traveled to Libya, hoping to make it to Europe. The doors to Europe closed, though, so she paid smugglers to take her across the Sinai Desert in Egypt. When she got to the Israeli border, she was arrested and taken to Saharonim prison in southern Israel. But less than a month later, she was freed and taken to Tel Aviv. She has lived in Israel for 9 years, allowed to work, but with no official legal status. She's married and has a young daughter. and tonight she's sharing her culture with a group of interested Israelis.
It's our bread, like bread in everywhere. We are using this, only we are changing the sauce. Every day of our life, it's we are eating this, and it's pre-gluten, it's healthy. That's why we are not fat people.
The participants each paid $50 for the evening and say it's well worth it. Adi Sildulkin says that until tonight, she'd never had a real conversation with an asylum seeker.
You can form an opinion based on things that you don't know or things that you fear. And then once, like even seeing here people interacting, and then once you know somebody, like get to know them and speak with them, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, they're people just like me, and they deserve rights just like I do.
Ellie Levy says asylum seekers in Israel should have more rights.
They are here, they exist here, and we can't ignore it. And we should help, especially the to become a good citizen here in Israel.
This is exactly what Yael Ravid, the co-director of Kitchen Talks, likes to hear.
As we cook together shoulder to shoulder, we literally break bread, not as a metaphor, but as a real happening together. And I'm hoping that they will enjoy the holiday feast that we're preparing for the Eritrean Christmas, Lidat. And they will get a chance to know Asmait, our Eritrean cook, and to ask her questions about her life, about her home kitchen, how she grew up, how she came here. And
Ravid said she hopes the participants take home not only recipes, but new friendships. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Tel Aviv.
Breakthrough singer Billie Eilish is set to sing the theme song for the upcoming James Bond film, becoming the youngest artist to write and record a song for the iconic film franchise. Eilish, who turned 18 in December, recorded the song for the 25th Bond film, No Time to Die, which debuts in U.S. theaters on April 10th. She wrote the song with her brother Phineas. The two created her entire debut album together. The untitled new song does not have a release date. Eilish is riding high, though, on her successful 2019 debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? It was featured the number one hit, Bad Guy, and she's also competing for 6 Grammy Awards at this month's show, including the top 4 prizes, Album, Song, and Record of the Year, as well as Best New Artist. She was just 17 when she earned those 4 top nominations, making her the youngest artist in Grammy history to achieve the feat. When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Was also Spotify's most streamed album of 2019. Well, you have been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Oh,
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.